The current U.S. President Trump administration is starting a trade war. This is unprecedented since the 1930s.
Trade issues remain sticky between the United States and China. It's Monday, June 4th. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're also on Facebook at VOA Asia. Coming up, hope remains for resolution 4 years after a plane disappears. Tank Man, the iconic photo that almost never happened. India's House of Peace. Swallowing your diagnosis. Picasso in Hong Kong. It's all on today's VOA Asia. China is warning the United States any trade and business agreements between the two countries will be void if President Donald Trump carries out his threats to impose tariff hikes and other trade measures. The warning came after U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross and Chinese Deputy Prime Minister Liu He ended a new round of talks Sunday in Beijing, aimed at settling a simmering trade dispute in which Beijing pledged to buy more American products to narrow its trade surplus with the United States. The Chinese trade surplus reached $375 billion last year. No joint statement was issued. Neither side released details. Trump is threatening to hike duties on up to $150 billion of Chinese imports, with Beijing vowing to retaliate in kind. The White House renewed a threat last week to hike duties on $50 billion of Chinese technology-related goods in that dispute. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Jeffrey Bergstrand, professor of finance at Notre Dame University.
Well, first of all, the Trump administration was the start of all this in terms of raising tariffs, especially on manufactured goods, steel in particular, also aluminum, but it's done it on countries around the world. So the response by China in terms of, say, voiding any trade and business agreements as a retaliatory measure is feasible. How much impact that will have is pretty limited. Basically, it's a retaliatory measure. But the notion that they are going to curtail trade and business agreements doesn't have much impact because those could be small agreements, those could be partnership agreements, but they're not under the rules of an economic integration agreement.
How much different is the Trump policy and style in negotiating and talking with China as his predecessors?
Completely different. The U.S. president, the current U.S. president, Trump administration is starting a trade war. Historically, this is unprecedented since the 1930s, where the most similar situation would have been the Smoot-Hawley tariffs, which were brought in under Hoover, and that exacerbated the Great Recession of the early 1930s into the Great Depression with the collapse of world trade, which collapsed by about two-thirds.
Do you think this is a war of simply threats, or do you expect a trade war, a real trade war, to break out? And if so, what kind of effect is that going to have on the American and Chinese consumer?
Well, the way I see it is that a trade war exists once at least one party starts creating barriers to trade, which these tariffs on steel and aluminum will do. And then we know it's a war because the other side responds. China responds by raising tariffs proportionally to do as much damage as was done to them. Same thing for the European Union, Canada, and Mexico. So once you have one party starts creating protectionism, which is what the Trump administration is doing, and other parties partake in terms of a tit-for-tat kind of situation, you are in a trade war. The big issue is, how bad will it be?
And what would be the effect on the consumers, be they in China, be they in the United States, or even worldwide?
What happens is this is going to lower the overall volume of trade. And so in the end, employment will go down in these industries. You know, in the short run, it's going to boost employment. But, you know, within a couple of years, the collapse of the world economy will eventually hurt employment and create very high unemployment in the country and depressing economic conditions.
You're calling for the collapse of the world economy?
It depends on the degree to which this escalates. Given what they've done so far, it's damaging the U.S. economy and damaging the Chinese economy and the other economies where these are going into play. If it escalates to a much higher degree, then it could collapse the world economy. It's not at that level yet. It's just the first round. So it's a beginning, but it could stop. It could stop here. Or it could escalate. Very hard to see at this point.
VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaking with Jeffrey Bergstrand, professor of finance at Notre Dame University. While the U.S.-China trade and tariff disputes remain unresolved, Trump last week imposed new tariffs on steel and aluminum imports from the European Union, Canada, and Mexico, angering three key U.S. allies who vowed to retaliate by imposing new duties on American goods. These are among some of the top Asia stories currently trending on voanews.com. Secretary of Defense Mattis says sanctions stay on North Korea until denuclearization progresses. China warns U.S. tariffs will undo existing deals. Indonesia raids campus, detains three terror suspects. China steps up Uyghur crackdown during Ramadan. Police fire on funeral of Kashmir man killed by soldiers. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia. You'll also find them at our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. The U.S.-based Ocean Infinity says its search for the wreckage of Malaysian Airlines flight MH370, missing for 4 years, will shortly come to an end following a much larger and expensive international effort to solve one of modern aviation's great mysteries. The Boeing 777 disappeared soon after takeoff from Kuala Lumpur March 8, 2014, on a flight to Beijing with 239 people, mostly Chinese, aboard. Fragments believed to have been part of the aircraft washed ashore on western Indian Ocean coastlines. Families of the victims have demanded the search go on. Clive Kessler, a longtime Malaysia expert and professor emeritus at the University of New South Wales, tells VOA's Victor Beattie there would be two compelling reasons to restart the search.
On the specific grounds that there are the families of those 239 people who were on the aeroplane who died, who disappeared, and who need to know what happened. And the general case is, look, here, this is a matter of confidence in world aviation itself, and they can't just let a plane disappear and say, oh, look, terribly sorry about that, it went astray, nothing more to be said.
Now, Malaysian government is due out with a report on the search and the disappearance of the aircraft, and there's some concern that it will be fully transparent. Do you think it will be?
I can't be sure about that. What they have agreed to do is to release the report that was prepared by the previous government. And they have said that they are quite happy to open it up, as they are with a number of things that the previous government did, in order to let people see what went on and to confirm the doubts in many ways that people had about the previous government. I have doubts that the report produced by the previous government, even if it's transparently revealed, will tell very much, because there was an enormous amount of face and hypothesis saving went on after the series of misjudgments that went into the initial crisis management and initiation of the search. My suspicion is that the report that was prepared, and which will now be revealed, will be part of, if not a cover-up, part of the same fudging and blurring of the issues that the Malaysian government, the previous Malaysian government, was into from really the word go in many ways.
Is there anything beyond just pure theory and speculation as to what happened to this aircraft?
Look, there's not much that's washed up. There are some people who said a lot of stuff washed up on Mozambique that may or may not have been, but the fact that nothing washed up is compatible with two totally contradictory scenarios. One is that the plane crashed as it did. There was high impact, and it was a time when a cyclone went through, and the bottom of the Indian Ocean is a great churn, like a huge washing machine, and everything just got crunched up and pulverized into tiny fragments. The other view, and this is the view of these four experienced pilots, is that if it was a controlled landing, then most of the aircraft, with the exception of that part wing, the flapper on or something that came off at impact, would have remained intact together and gone down in one or two or three large pieces in close proximity to the bottom of the ocean.
Well, regardless of which scenario may or may not be true, the fact is this aircraft was off course. It was on a flight in March 2014 from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing, had no business being over the Indian Ocean.
Absolutely not. It's quite clear now that the pilot or somebody in the plane who they have hijacked, it was probably the pilot, diverted the aeroplane, turned it round across the Gulf of Siam, back across the Malay Peninsula, into the Andaman Sea, did a very complicated navigational route across the fuzzy zones between Malaysian and Thai airspace and Malaysian and Indonesian airspace, and evaded the main way stations in order to get through and get out into the southern Indian Ocean.
Clive Kessler said that is in line with one of the few clues about the fate of Flight MH370, Inmarsat communication satellite data that indicates the plane crashed in the southern Indian Ocean. Happening now in Asia, the summit between President Donald Trump and North Korea's Kim Jong-un will go on as originally planned on June 12th in Singapore. The U.S. president made the announcement at the White House after receiving a letter from Kim that was hand-delivered by his top nuclear negotiator. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're starting out your week with us on VOA Asia. 29 years ago, a violent suppression of peaceful demonstrations in and around Tiananmen Square resulted in the countless loss of innocent lives. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo released a statement calling on the Chinese government to make a full public accounting of those killed, detained, or missing, to release those who have been jailed for striving to keep the memory of Tiananmen Square alive, and to end the continued harassment of demonstration participants and their families. Meanwhile, a Chinese artist in Australia has called for people around the world to pose as the iconic Tank Man on this day to commemorate the 29th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square crackdown. Tank Man was an unidentified man who stood in front of a line of moving tanks the next day on June 5, 1989. The identity of the man and his eventual fate remain unknown. We do know who took the photograph, American Jeff Widener, who was working for the Associated Press. He shares his story of taking that photo and tells about some of the many obstacles that could have prevented the world from ever seeing it.
Well, I was a Southeast Asia picture editor for Associated Press. My job was basically to cover the southern region. However, this story was building into something really big, so they wanted me to come up there and help out on the story. The problem was that the Beijing government didn't want to give me a journalist visa, and they denied it. So I had to figure out another way to get into China. I booked a tourist, and when I got in there to the airport, I had to figure out a way to smuggle all my camera gear in. And this is a big concern. I thought I might get arrested. Fortunately, something was going on with an old lady and a live chicken in the corner of the terminal, and all the customs guys ran off to the side and left me alone, and I just pushed the cart through to the waiting taxis and got to the AP office. From that point on, my job was to go to Tiananmen Square every morning and photograph the activities. And it was, a very jovial experience, almost like a carnival atmosphere. Everybody was celebrating this new freedom that they had. Eventually, I was given the order to do the first night shift. On the night of June 4th, I went out, and things started really getting pretty heavy. There was a burning armored car, and I lifted the camera to my eye. At the second, a large brick hit me in the face. The camera absorbed the blow. Fortunately, it saved my life. And then I had to get back to the AP office and file. I didn't go back out. I was just too scared. I was sick. I had a massive concussion. And the following day, I got a message again from AP. We don't want anyone to take any unnecessary risk, but if somebody could please photograph the occupied Tiananmen Square, we'd appreciate it. So I drew the small straw again, and it was my job to go to the Beijing Hotel, which had the closest vantage point. And I got there, and I had to get past secret police who were using electric cattle prods on the journalist. Fortunately, one young college kid from America named Kirk Martson, he managed to smuggle me up into his room, And that's where I made the tank man photograph.
This must have been an absolutely astounding scene that was playing out before your eyes as you're watching this lone gentleman walk out into the street in front of a line of tanks.
It was and it wasn't, because you have to remember I had a massive concussion. I was really spaced out, and nothing was really making a lot of sense to me. So seeing a guy walking out in the middle of a boulevard with shopping bags and confronting tanks just seemed par for the course. And actually, when I saw the tanks coming down the street, I lined up my 400-millimeter lens, and I thought, well, you know, it's a nice shot. And the guy walks out, and the first thing I said, well, this guy's going to screw up my composition. And then Kirk's screaming, they're going to kill him, they're going to kill him. And so, you know, I looked at this guy just waiting for the instant he was going to be, you know, shot. But nothing happened, you know, and he's just still there, standing there. And so I realized this, the picture was too far away, and I looked back at the bed where I had a lens doubler. This would increase my focal length to 800-millimeter. So the situation was, do I gamble and maybe miss the shot completely, or do I go and try to increase the magnification to get a better picture? Well, I did that, and I took three frames, and I realized something was wrong with my camera setting. The shutter speed was too slow. And by that time, Tank Man was taken away. It was an error I made on the sensitivity of the film, but fortunately, one picture came out.
One other interesting caveat to the story, Jeff Widener had run out of film and was fortunate enough to secure a roll of film from a tourist. That was the film used for the Tank Man photo. Coming up, Gathering for Peace and Coexistence. You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news from VOA Asia, U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis says international sanctions on North Korea will only be lifted when Pyongyang takes concrete steps to dismantle its nuclear program. Mattis, speaking alongside his South Korean and Japanese counterparts, attempted to dial back expectations for the ongoing talks between the United States and North Korea. Visit VOA Asia Facebook for developments. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, in an attempt to bridge the gap of understanding between different Indian communities, a house in the Indian capital of New Delhi is trying to foster the message of tolerance and peaceful coexistence in a unique manner. The house gives people from different religions and communities the chance to live together as a family for up to 6 months as a way to promote understanding. VOA's Rital Joshi reports from New Delhi.
In the Jamianagar neighborhood of Delhi, this nondescript narrow lane leads to a very special house. Sabka Ghar, or House for All, is an initiative to help people of different faiths understand each other.
The way we imagine India, a place where Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs and Christians live together and understand each other, Sabka Ghar is just that. A mini India.
Sabka Ghar is a place to get some relief. Here we talk of things which bring people together.
The idea for the house comes from an organization which is trying to revive the Khudai Khidmatgar movement in India. Khudai Khidmatgar, or Servants of God, was originally a social reform movement started by Khan Abdul Ghaffar Khan in India before its independence from Britain in 1947. Set up in 2017, this house allows people from different religions to stay under one roof as a family. 5 to 6 people can live here at a time for a minimum of 2 days to a maximum of 6 months.
We don't hold any workshops on peace and conflict here, nor do we give them lengthy notes. We just ask them simple questions like, were the Hindus created by China or America? They say, no, by Allah. Then why should there be any conflict, we say.
Our understanding of social coexistence widens, and slowly we see an improvement in ourselves too.
I get a chance to learn about other religions. With such understanding, I develop respect for other communities and religions.
So far, 1,600 people from across India have spent time in this house. Another Sabka Ghar house has opened its doors in the southern Indian state of Kerala to spread the message of tolerance and harmony. Rithul Joshi, VOA News, New Delhi.
This news from VOA Asia, a newly published report on education in Afghanistan, concludes nearly 44% of all children in the country are not going to schools, pushing the rate up for the first time since 2002. The report blames the ongoing conflict and worsening security situation, combined with deeply ingrained poverty and discrimination against girls. Everyone is welcome to visit VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, a pill could soon radio signals from inside your gut to help doctors diagnose diseases from ulcers to cancer to inflammation, according to a new study. Scientists have developed a small ingestible capsule that mixes biology and electronics to detect bleeding in the digestive tract. VOA Steve Barragona shares details.
The biological part of the pill uses bacteria engineered to glow when exposed to heme, the iron-containing molecule in blood. The electronic side includes a tiny light detector, computer chip, battery, and a transmitter that sends data to a cell phone or computer. It all fits in a capsule 3 centimeters long by 1 centimeter wide, says Massachusetts Institute of Technology electrical engineer Philip Nadeau.
You know, a major challenge for sensing in the GI tract is just the space available for a device is very limited.
Nadeau says with more engineering work, they can probably shrink the pill to a third of its current size. In laboratory tests, it successfully distinguished pigs fed small amounts of blood from those not given blood. It has not been tested on humans yet, but the team aims to do so in the next year or two. It's a good first step, but it may not be sensitive enough to detect disease in a real patient, says Rice University bioengineer Jeff Tabor, who was not part of the research team.
For many actual diseases, you might have far less of the molecule that you need to sense available to you in the body.
But Tabor says he's excited about the work, and it's a big advance. The research is published in the journal Science. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
Pablo Picasso's painting of Golden Muse, Marie Therese Walter, estimated to be worth up to $45 million, is on display in Hong Kong. The highly celebrated painting of his secret mistress of many years is the highlight of a collection of treasured works of art by old master painters that will be up for sale later in London. VOA's Julie Tabo tells us more.
A portrait of Pablo Picasso's Golden Muse, Marie Therese, debuted in Hong Kong on Friday, May 25th, ahead of Sotheby's summer season in London. The painting, unveiled in public for the first time in 20 years, is estimated to be worth as much as $45 million. It was painted in 1932, during Picasso's so-called Year of Wonders, when he is said to have been inspired by women, including Marie Therese and others, according to Sotheby's Augusto Uribe.
1932 is the golden year in which he really has a profoundly intimate relationship with Marie Therese. So paintings from that era, from that year in particular, are much more calm, tender, sweet. And as his relationship with her became a little more staid and slightly more antagonistic, then his depictions of her were a bit more, aggressive.
The painting is on display alongside a selection of Dutch and Flemish masterpieces before heading to London for a sale on June 19th. Classic masterpiece paintings are popular in the Asian market, says Andrew Fletcher, who heads Sotheby's Old Masters auction sales.
Collectors in Asia for Old Masters have tended in the past to come from Hong Kong. More and more, we see them coming from mainland China, from Taiwan. And we've also got more and more collectors coming from Japan as well.
Picasso, who died at the age of 91, was one of the most prolific artists of the 20th century, creating more than 13,000 paintings, along with countless prints and illustrations, in a career that spanned 78 years. Julie Tabo, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us online at iTunes and SoundCloud, of course, on our own website at voanews.com, and we stream every day on VOA Asia Facebook. We're also heard on the radio, like in Thailand, at PSU Radio Patani FM 107.25, Prince of Songkla University. We thank everyone there who tuned in today, and we always thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineers, Zina Bobdell-Rockman, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, including Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a terrific day.